Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Today I'm going to be talking about Aquinas on the identity of essence and existence in God. Aquinas, as you may have heard, accepts the doctrine of divine simplicity. Divine simplicity, as you also may have heard, can be thought of roughly, very roughly, as divine non-complexity. God isn't complex. But what is complex? Complexity means having a multiplicity of components or parts or constituents. So, for example, I have two arms and two legs, which means that I have a multiplicity of parts. So therefore, I am complex. So therefore, I am, at least in that respect, not simple. But God has no physical parts, so therefore he is, at least in that respect, simple. That is, not complex. Twice now, I've said, in that respect. It's important to realize that something can be simple in one respect, but complex in another. Angels, for example, are simple in the sense that they don't have a multiplicity of physical parts, which is obvious enough, inasmuch as they aren't physical at all. But in another sense, at least from Aquinas' perspective, angels are complex. For instance, there is a difference between an angel's nature and its various acts of understanding. So if someone asks whether something is complex or not, it's usually a good idea to ask, in what respect? Sometimes, in a particular argumentative context, it may be enough for Aquinas, or for us, to establish only that God is simple in a certain respect. For example, a particular argument may require only that God lack physical parts. In such contexts, the question doesn't arise whether God is simple in other respects, and still less, whether God is simple in every respect. Nevertheless, as you may have heard, Aquinas says that God is simple in every respect. He thinks, God is non-complex in every respect. One shouldn't assume that one knows what this comes to. For example, it's quite clear that for Aquinas, although God is simple, God exists in three persons. It's also quite clear that for Aquinas, God is simple, and yet the divine person, Jesus Christ, is composite. He says that, explicitly. So whatever divine simplicity means for Aquinas, it has to allow for things like that. And I don't think these are places where Aquinas takes back some of the simplicity claims. It's weirder than that. I don't have a lot to say about Aquinas' Trinitarian theology, but I've come to think that divine simplicity isn't a problem for the Trinity. It's actually the secret to the doctrine of the Trinity. As for the incarnation, I do have a little bit to say. When Aquinas says that God is simple, he means that anything that's God is simple insofar as it's God. He's just not addressing the question of what would be going on if some divine person had another nature. Now, if it did, then insofar as it had two natures, it would be composite. And if it had a human nature, it would have two hands. So it would be composite in that way too. But none of that affects that still qua divine, God is just the second person of the Trinity is just as simple as the Father is, qua divine. But anyway, these are things that sound inconsistent with divine simplicity. So whatever you mean by divine simplicity, you have to allow for those. All right, so that's a lot of wide-ranging remarks on divine simplicity. But I'm really just trying to set the stage for a rather narrow-ranging topic. My job in this talk is to explain Aquinas' view that God is simple in the sense that, in this respect, He's not composed of essence and existence. And so to do that, I will engage the following topic. So that's what's on the whiteboard there. If you can't see it, don't worry. It's just the outline. First, Roman numeral one there. Saying that God is not composed of essence and existence makes sense only insofar as essence and existence can be thought of as components. If they aren't components, then it would be impossible for anything to be composed of them. And if it's impossible for anything to be composed of them, then there's nothing special about the fact that God is simple in that respect. Simplicity with respect to things that aren't components in the first place is only a kind of pseudo-simplicity. So the first question is, are essence and existence components of things? What could that mean? So the first part, I'm going to talk about what essence and existence are and whether they can be components. Second, having done what I can to make sense of the idea that essence and existence can be components, I will discuss why, for Aquinas, they can't be components in God. That's section two. Next, third, I will comment briefly on a contrast between thinking of existence minimally and thinking of existence maximally. Fourth, I will discuss how Aquinas' views on this narrow topic flow into his thoughts about God's universal perfection and creatures sharing in it. By the end of this, I hope you will see that the identity of essence and existence in God is not just an arcane fact that some metaphysically minded people like to talk about, but absolutely crucial to our understanding both of what God is and how creatures are related to God. And fifth, I will say a few things about simplicity and language about God, and I hope that what I say will complement the detailed accounts you already got from Professor Hochschild. So, section one, what are essence and existence, and how could they be components of anything? If you feel a little nervous and worried about speaking of essence and existence as components or parts or constituents, I think that's good, because the sense in which they are components is not obvious. I'll take essence first. Here's something that's true but misleading. Every being has an essence. It's misleading because it sounds like every dog has a tail. So it sounds like you're saying every being has something, some entity, an entity that we call its essence. But essences aren't things that beings have, at least not in the way that tails are things that dogs have. Essences really aren't things at all in any ordinary sense. As the late philosopher Jonathan Lowe said, not everything is a thing. So let's just restart this discussion of essence. And we'll restart it by simply noting the following important fact. There are no generic beings, nothing that's just a being. Everything is always a being of a certain type, one type or another. So just as nothing is just an animal, but it's always a Delmarva fox squirrel or a black and white warbler or whatever, so too, nothing is just a being. It's a Delmarva fox squirrel, or a black and white warbler, or an angel, something. So every being is a being of a certain kind. Well, that's the point of saying that every being has an essence. Just as we say, everybody's got a point of view, without supposing that a point of view is a thing that you can hold in your hand or show the TSA agent, so too, we could say everything has an essence and not mean thereby that an essence is a thing possessed by the being that, quote unquote, has it. The point is simply that each being is not a raw, undifferentiated, mere being, but instead a being of a particular sort, whatever that sort turns out to be. Okay, so far I've been making remarks that are intended to discourage you from thinking of essences as if they were little thingies had by beings. But such remarks, to the extent that you take them to heart, will discourage you from thinking of essences as components. So I don't want to go too far. So, given all these warnings, still, what sense can we make to think of essence as a part? Let's go back to that black and white warbler. It's essential to it that it be warm-blooded, that it be winged, and so on. But there's more to it than these essential traits. It's sitting on a particular branch right now, but that's hardly essential to it. It might well have been flying, and indeed it will be flying soon, especially if I keep talking so loud. To speak of it in terms of its essential traits is then only to give a partial account of it. It's to speak of it only in part. In short, its essence, you might say, is only a part of it. Not in the way that a tail is part of a dog, but still in some analogous way. If there's more to a bird than its essential features, then in some sense the essential features are only part of the bird, and its accidental features and whatever other strange things a metaphysician might care to point to are other parts. If there are parts, then in some sense they make up a whole, or you might say, they compose the whole. Well, if you've come with me this far, you might as well say that these things that compose the whole are components of the whole. So an essence is, in this rather fanciful or extended sense, a component of a being. You might even say that the being has it. Now, when I say essence, you might be wondering, am I talking about Platonic universals? No. Aquinas, I'm trying to channel Aquinas for you here, right? Aquinas does not go for Platonic universals. Am I talking about the common nature absolutely considered? I don't think so. The common nature absolutely considered is the common nature absolutely considered. It has no real being. What I'm talking about is the individual natures existing in individual things. Socrates has his human nature. Plato has his. You have yours. I don't mean Socrates' Socrateity, which is, of course, different in kind from Plato's Platonicity. If indeed we should believe in things like that, I'm inclined to say no. I mean rather Socrates' humanity as distinct from Plato's humanity. Of course, they are exactly alike, as like as two peas in a pod, and actually more alike than that. But they are different numerically. They're different in number. Socrates' humanity is his. Plato's is his. I have said that each being has an essence, and that its essence is, so to speak, only a part of it, only one component of it. And I've made that point by noting that beings have accidents as well. But accidents are not the only parts that an essence can be contrasted with, nor are they the parts that we need to focus on here. There's also existence, or esse, E-S-S-E. In Aquinas' Latin, essence is a component contrasted with existence as a component. But what is existence? Well, of course, I'm going to say it's complicated. Let's start with something that is, I hope, obvious. You and I exist. That's a fact. Tyrannosaurs used to exist, but they don't anymore. There's no longer any fact of their existing. Unicorns don't exist and never have, presumably. There's no fact of their existing, and there never has been. In one sense, then, existence is a fact. It's the fact that something is actual and not just potential. Existence is the actuality of a potentiality. If existence is actuality, it's only fair to ask what it's the actuality of. What is the potentiality that gets actualized by existence? The answer is essence. The existence of a cat, Mickey, let's say, is the actualization of felinity. It's the actualization of the potentiality for something to exist in a feline way. Existence and essence, then, understood as actuality and potentiality, are an important pair in Thomistic metaphysics. Are they parts? Well, if you only talk about the existence of something, you're only giving a partial account of it. You're mentioning that the thing is actual, but you're not indicating what kind of thing it is. You're not indicating what essence, its existence, is an actualization of. There's more to something than its existence, and likewise for its essence. This suggests that we can think of the essence of something as one of its components and of its existence as another one of its components. Once we start thinking of existence as a component, however, we'll realize that we've started to slide away from thinking of existence only as the fact of a thing's being actual. We've started thinking of it also as an internal factor that results in the factual existence of a thing. On this approach, shared by more than a few Thomists, every substance has two basic contributing factors or internal metaphysical principles or parts or components. Not only its nature or essence, but also its existence, with existence here referring not to the fact that the substance actually exists, but instead to an internal factor or principle in virtue of which that substance actually exists. This principle is sometimes called existence as act, or the actus essendi. Mickey the cat is the product, as it were, of two core principles, essence and existence as act. It's because of his essence that Mickey is the kind of thing he is, and it's because of his existence as act that he's something rather than nothing. The result of them both is Mickey himself, who has both essence and existence as fact. So you'll notice that this gives us two ways of talking about existence: existence as act and existence as fact. So that makes it complicated. In all of this talk of essence and existence, we face the danger of reification. We should try to avoid thinking of essence as being like a little machine, with existence as the electricity that gets the machine to go, that actualizes. We should try to avoid thinking of essences as like those little, do they still have these little animal-shaped sponges that like children get, and then you drop them in water and they puff up? So like the sponge is the essence and then the water's like the existence. It's not like that. So it's actually quite difficult, I think, to take seriously the component-like character of essence and existence without falling into treating them as little mini substances, junior substances perhaps. It's hard to work this out. All right, so if essence and existence are in some sense distinct principles or parts or components, it seems to follow that an essence doesn't automatically come with existence. Instead, whenever something with a certain essence actually exists, there must have been something responsible for the actualization of that essence. That's why Mickey has to have a cause, something to bring it about that he actually exists. So there's a tight connection between the following two points. A, in pretty much anything you can think of, essence and existence are distinct principles or components. B, pretty much anything you can think of needed a cause to bring it into existence. Well, why did I say pretty much anything you can think of? I'm not just being cautious. I do, in fact, have an exception in mind, and I'm sure you know what it is. It's God. For Aquinas, now this leads us to section two, essence and existence are not distinct components in God. In God, essence and existence are identical. God's existence is his essence, and vice versa, if you want to put it that way. Now, if you already believe in divine simplicity, then of course you will want to say what I just said. Right? If you already know that God is simple, then these things just have to be identical. So you can, if you want, argue from divine simplicity to the identity of essence and existence in God. But Aquinas' strategy, as you may have heard, is closer to the opposite of that. He argues for the identity of essence and existence in God as part of his strategy for convincing you that God is simple, right? You know this from the presentations on the first day, right? Is he complex in this way? No. How about this way? No. Aquinas cuts out all these modes of complexity and then finally says, well, I guess he's simple. So I don't want to just present that as this identity of essence and existence as, for Aquinas, following from divine simplicity. It's got to follow from something else. So how can we give reasons for identifying essence and existence in God without taking divine simplicity as one of our premises? Well, one thing you could do would be to argue that it follows from God's perfection, which was suggested in the previous talk. But I don't think that's what Aquinas is doing. So I'm just going to give you an argument for this view. And it's the idea is that God, the identity of essence and existence in God, follows from the fact that God is the first being, which was essentially what was proved in question two, in let's say at least four of the five ways. So the argument I'm going to be giving you right now for the identity of essence and existence is based on, although not exactly the same as, an argument that Aquinas gives in question three in the discussion of divine simplicity. If a being A, let's call the being A, if a being contains anything other than its essence, that extra something isn't going to be there without some explanation. It has to be caused either externally by something that lies outside of A, or else internally by something that lies inside of A. So let's consider these two options as applied to the case when A is God and the something extra is existence. God's existence can't be caused by something that lies outside of God, because God is uncaused. If the existence of what we call God was caused by something from outside, then what we call God wouldn't really be God. The alternative is for God's existence to be caused by something inside of God. The only reasonable candidate here, it seems, would be God's essence. But there are at least two reasons to deny that God's existence is caused by his essence. First, if God's existence were caused by his essence, then the God, quote unquote, whose existence was thus caused, would be a caused being. It would be downstream from and secondary to the divine essence. But then this so-called God wouldn't be God at all. Instead, the divine essence would be the real God, the real uncaused or unsourced being. Second, it doesn't even make sense to talk about God's essence causing God's existence. An essence can't do anything unless it's actual. But if God's essence is actual, then God already exists, in which case there could be no question of causing him to exist. Okay, so if God's existence isn't caused by the divine essence, could it be caused by divine accidents? Now, for starters, God doesn't have any accidents. But even if he did, that wouldn't help. Accidents depend on substances. If divine accidents existed, they would depend on God. But then they couldn't cause him because nothing can cause what it depends on. But why believe that if God's existence is distinct from his essence, it needs to be caused at all? Can't it just be there automatically, so to speak? If you say that, then I think you're really saying that God's existence is essential to him. But if you agree with that, then you aren't disagreeing with Aquinas. You're agreeing with him. So it's not that great an objection. Okay, so let's return to the main argument. If there are only two ways for God's existence to be different from God's essence, by being caused internally or by being caused externally, and if neither of those ways makes any sense, then God's existence is not different from his essence. Instead, God's existence and God's essence are the same thing as each other. We talk and think about them as if they were different. They are conceptually distinct, but really, in reality, they are the same. His essence is his existence. His essence is not to be this sort of thing or that sort of thing, but simply to be. This is why Thomists have sometimes pointed with delight at what God says in Exodus 3:14, I am who am. It's worth pausing for a moment to note the connection between this form of divine simplicity and God's necessary existence. If God's very essence or nature involves his existence, then he can't not exist. He must exist. In short, he will be a necessary being. If you wish, you can express this by saying that he exists in all possible worlds. But it's best to think of this, I would say it's best to think of this as a somewhat fanciful metaphor. Lest we slip into thinking that the possible worlds are there, ontologically prior to God, in such a way that God is just one of those lucky beings who gets to exist in all of them. No, God is prior to everything else in every way. Whatever sense can be made of the notion of possible worlds, it can't be a sense that involves God's being posterior to them. Okay, having discussed why we should believe that essence and existence are identical in God, I want now to say a little something about two ways of thinking about existence. I mean, I've already given you two ways, but this is a different distinction. So this is section three. There are two ways to think about the claim that God's essence is identical to his existence. One is to think of existence minimally. On this way of thinking, to exist is to just barely be there at all. On this way of thinking, anything that's even a tiny bit interesting must not only exist, but have something more, life, rationality, or whatever. So you can say, well, rocks just exist, but animals exist and live. Like, that's a thing that somebody might say. But that's when you say like that, you're thinking of existence in a minimal way. The other way to think of existence is to think of it maximally. On this way of thinking, essences don't add to being. They delimit it and restrict it. To be a cat, for example, is indeed to be mammalian and meowing, but it's also not to be a rock or an angel or a fish. To have an essence is to be of a certain sort in contrast with being of any other sort. Essences are how we define things, and anything that is defined or definite is defined or definite precisely in virtue of having a limit. And the word definition comes from finis, a Latin word for limit. On this maximalist interpretation, to say that God's essence is existence is not to say that God is just barely there, but on the contrary, to say that God has unlimited existence. Obviously, this is the better way to go. This is Aquinas' idea. Okay, so if we think of existence in this maximalist way, it follows that anything in which essence and existence are identical is something whose existence is infinite, undelimited, unlimited. Such a being will be universally perfect. So let's talk about God's universal perfection together with creatures, with how creatures share in God's universal perfection. So that's section 4 here. That God is perfect may seem obvious to us, but in fact, it should not simply be assumed or taken for granted. In ancient Greek myths, the gods were often to be found fighting, committing adultery, tricking one another. Such gods are fun to read about. I mean, I don't deny that. But they're not perfect in any sense that you or I would recognize. That's not the only point. Even if it is somehow obvious that God is perfect, it's not obvious what perfection means. Perfect comes from a Latin word meaning thoroughly made, and by extension, complete. Something is perfect if it's complete, if it has it all. But an important distinction needs to be made. In one way, perfect means having everything that is required for your kind or nature or essence. So think of bowling. If you roll 12 strikes in a row, the game is over. You've scored 300 points. That's a perfect game. Not even God could get a higher score. If you get that score, you have completely maxed out all the potentialities in bowling. Bowling has nothing more to offer you. This is fullness or perfection for the kind of game that bowling is. If you were to get a perfect game in bowling, that would be fantastic. But think of all the other things you would not have accomplished in the course of doing so. You would not have hit any home runs or stolen any bases. You would not have proven any mathematical theorems. You would not have changed any diapers. Even if you changed a diaper while the game was in progress, you would not have done so as part of rolling the perfect game. So while a perfect game is a game that has everything, the word everything here really means everything that bowling has to offer. It doesn't mean everything that there possibly could be. Something that had everything that there possibly could be would be perfect in a stronger and deeper sense. In short, there are two senses of perfect. One is this, having everything good that belongs to your nature. A perfect dog has four legs, a tail, a good sense of smell, and so on. A perfect book has a sound binding, all of its pages, and so on. A perfect game in bowling has 300 points. But the other sense is this, having every possible goodness, period. Aquinas calls this universal perfection. So with this distinction in hand, we can say not merely that God is perfect, but that he's universally perfect. The argument relies on something that we saw in the previous section, namely that God's, well, the previous two sections, that God's essence and existence are identical, combined with the thought that existence is here being understood maximally. To be God is to be, not just in the sense of just barely being there, again, but in the sense of having unlimited existence. God has every possible form of being and goodness to the maximum extent possible. That is what universal perfection is. Now, if God is universally perfect, meaning that he has every possible kind of perfection, then a fortiori, he has every perfection that creatures can have. That's what makes it possible for him to create beings with those perfections. He gives what he himself has. But this needs reflection and even refinement in light of an important objection. Think of Mickey the cat. Mickey has a tail, and indeed it belongs to the perfection of a cat that it had a tail. If having a tail is a perfection, and if God has all perfections, does that mean that God has a tail? Okay, so presumably the answer is no. Then the question becomes, what happened to the idea that God has all perfections? So the way forward is to realize that there's a difference between how perfections exist in God and how perfections exist in creatures. God has all modes of being, but he has them in a superior way or an eminent way. Let me try to explain this a bit using the example of God's knowledge. You could have a whole conference on this. But I'll just say a little bit of something. When we say that God knows all things, we don't mean that he knows things in the same way we do, except that he knows all of them. It's not as if God's knowledge consists in the fact that if you ask him questions, he can recall the answers. And that what makes him special is that he can do it super fast and for all possible questions. It's more like this. God has knowledge of all things all at once in one simple gaze. He has, you might say, one big thought, a thought that contains all truths in one big conception. When we say that God has a certain perfection, then, we need to think of that perfection as existing in him in a higher way. You might wonder how this would apply to a perfection like having a tail. You can't apply it straightforwardly, of course, but maybe the following is on the right track. Whatever makes tails good for cats, God has that. And he has it to the maximal degree. I don't know, why do cats have tails? Maybe it's to help them balance. And why do you need good balance? It's part of being an effective agent. Well, although God doesn't literally have a tail, he is an effective agent, and indeed a maximally effective agent. Having a tail in a cat contributes to the cat's resembling, in a secondary and imperfect way, the perfect effectiveness of God. The relationship between God's infinite way of possessing perfections and creatures' finite way of possessing them can be viewed differently, namely from the side of the creatures. Each thing that exists imitates God's infinite and universally perfect reality. Further, each thing that exists receives its reality from God as the ultimate source. But this imitative reception always involves the creatures falling short of the source that it receives from and imitates. One way to put this is to say that creatures have partial versions of what God has. They take their features from him, but they take them only partially. They take part in, or participate in, what he has, not by participation, but instead essentially and maximally. God is the source of everything else. He's upstream from everything else, and everything else is downstream from him. He is what explains everything else, and nothing explains him. He's responsible for everything else being the way it is, and nothing is responsible for him being the way he is. Nothing is before him or prior to him in any way. Which means, among other things, that he does not fit into any larger context or find his place in any larger setting, like the cosmos or a possible world. He could have been the only thing that ever existed, and the only reason that's not the case is that he freely chose for other things to exist. Everything depends on God in a completely radical way, and he's extremely different from everything other than himself. God is so very different from everything else that he doesn't really belong to the categories of being. If you had to choose, of course, you would assign him to the category of substance. But really, you shouldn't choose. He exists beyond the categories. Categories are for creatures. So looking at this from the side of creation, every creature is downstream from God, receptive rather than an unsourced source, explained rather than an unexplained explainer, posterior rather than prior, in every possible way. Creatures exist and exist as they do only because God grants this to them, and what he grants is inevitably only a participated version of what he himself already is. So creatures are like God, but only partially, and the difference is always greater than the similarity. Traditionally, these points have been discussed under the heading of the triplex via, the threefold road, or threefold way. The three ways are these: causation, negation, immanence. First, by considering that God By considering things that God has caused, we infer that he must in some way have the features or perfections found in those caused things. For example, if God has caused elephants, then since elephants are powerful, God must in some way be powerful. Second, we deny or negate all imperfection in the content that we're attributing to God. For example, power in created things involves overcoming obstacles. But nothing can be an obstacle for God, who is the source of everything other than himself, including those very things that one might have thought of as being obstacles for him. So our understanding of divine power must exclude the notion of overcoming opposition. Third, we include as best we can a higher or eminent mode in the perfections that we do attribute to him. Looking at this from the side of creatures, it's worth realizing that creatures are what they are in virtue of imitating God. That's to say, in virtue of imitating him in a limited way. To exist in a feline way, as cats do, is to imitate God in a very partial or limited fashion. If you are tempted to think of felinity, capital F, as a special kind of object that all cats are related to, but if you also worry that this makes your metaphysical system kind of odd and spooky, a little too Platonic, consider the possibility that maybe we just don't need felinity with a capital F as a middleman. Mickey and all the other cats don't imitate felinity with a capital F. They imitate God. All right, so last section. I want to conclude by saying just a little bit about how divine simplicity relates to our language about God. Aquinas, like Gilbert Ryle, is aware that the way we talk about things doesn't always line up with the way they are. For example, Aquinas tells us that we speak of the act of creation as if it were a change, when it isn't. The case of simplicity and complexity is similar. We speak about things in a way that always suggests complexity. There's a subject, and then there's something predicable of it. We talk about Socrates that way, and in truth, he is like that. We talk about God that way, but he isn't like that. For example, we say that God is powerful, and this gives the impression that he's a being that has a certain component, namely his power. But that's the wrong impression. God just is infinite subsisting being, in which power and wisdom and everything else is somehow included in an undifferentiated whole. If that's the way things are, why do we talk the way we do? Ryle suggests that we should sometimes rephrase misleading expressions. Does Aquinas say similarly that we should rephrase the things we say about God? Mostly he doesn't. And it's worth asking why. I think that on one level, as a matter of temperament, Aquinas just simply wasn't much of a linguistic reformer. When he thinks a phrase is misleading, he'll clarify it. But he seems happy enough to let everyone keep using it that way, including himself. But maybe there's another reason, too. If you try to think of how to avoid speaking misleadingly about God, you may come to the conclusion that it's impossible to avoid this in a way that's still helpful. So we start with a bunch of individual words about God. We say that he's powerful, he's wise, he's just, and so on. We use each of these words to somehow convey something different. We use each of them to imitate or intimate We use each of them to intimate one particular aspect of what God is. We say that he is omnipotent insofar as he can do everything. We say that he's omniscient insofar as he knows everything, and so on. Now, on the basis of certain arguments, we know that although our words for these are different, and our concepts of them are different, still they aren't different. But can we get very far in the project of reforming our language so it conveys this better? If we tried to speak about God in a way that modeled his simplicity, what would it look like? We wouldn't say that God was wise and powerful, because that would make it seem as if his wisdom and powerful were distinct. So instead we'd say that he's wise, powerful. But then, of course, there's justice and mercy to worry about. So we'd have to say that he was wise, powerful, just, merciful. Just one long word. If this makes sense, really we should just go all the way and say God is God. And even that has the disadvantage that suggesting that somehow there's two things that like make up one thing. So we should just stop using sentences at all and just say God. Now you can do that. It's a free country. But for someone who doesn't know what God is like, it's not helpful. Not at all. Perhaps it's therefore better to stick with our ordinary language, misleading though it is. Maybe we have to accept a certain trade-off. The person who hears it said that God is wise thereby learns something important, even if there's a risk that he'll get thrown off the scent a little bit. You can always come back to him and say, oh, and by the way, you know, when I said God is wise, just try not to forget that although when we say that God is wise, we're bringing out a different aspect of God than we're bringing out when we say that he's powerful, still in God himself. You know, these are really just all one big thing. So we use the misleading expressions, and then we point out their misleadingness. This seems to be a better strategy, a more informative one, than trying against the grain to represent God as he really is. We can't represent God as he really is, at least not in this life. Our minds can only grasp reality one slice at a time. And what's more, we are, so to speak, constrained to think of the world as consisting of objects characterized by properties. Our minds don't do simplicity. We keep bouncing from one thing to another, trying to put them together in a way that's as true to the facts as we can manage. Maybe someday, in a very different setting, we'll be able to stop bouncing around and to be still and to know that he is God. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.